the 27th episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show. I'm Tema Frank, your host. I'd like to thank IBM Canada for their continued generous sponsorship of this show. Today we're moving slightly away from the traditional corporate sector. The interview today is with Derek Kassoff, who works in McGill University's Alumni Relations Department. And we're talking about how McGill is using social media in particular to reach out to more alumni and form deeper connections with alumni. If you work in any nonprofit organization, I think you'll find lots of interesting ideas in here. And even if you don't work in a nonprofit, I think there's some interesting comparisons to be made with the not-for-profit versus the for-profit pure business sector. And in fact, a lot of what Derek is saying is that they need to become a little more businesslike in their approach. Enjoy the show, and I will talk to you after the interview.
I arrived at McGill about 4.5 years ago, and it was just after social media was going mainstream. And at that point, we really weren't doing much in terms of engaging our alumni with social media. We're doing the traditional, you know, print magazines, newsletters, and a lot of email, you know, an abundance of email, I would say, but not really much in terms of social media. So we started, you know, we saw that the trend was going that way. People were spending more and more of their waking hours on social media, and it was becoming sort of a more of a mainstream communications tool. And we thought it was important if we wanted to maintain a connection with our alumni and continue to engage them, that we build a presence on some of the top social media platforms. We had done a little bit on LinkedIn before I arrived. Our LinkedIn group was actually started by, you know, alums who just wanted to connect with each other. And then eventually we kind of, you know, connected with those people and asked if we can sort of take over the administration of LinkedIn. And I believe Facebook started the same way. There was a McGill alumni Facebook page that, you know, a random alum decided to start one day. And we eventually had those migrated to our, you know, administrative, administration. And the alumni in those cases were fine with that.
Right.
So we sort of built it up from there. And initially it was just a question of having those platforms available as places where alumni can connect with us, connect with each other and hang out. And our initial strategy was as simple as saying that we want to be where our alumni are, and if they're no longer, you know, watching the 6 o'clock news every evening, or, you know, waiting at their mailbox for the print magazine to arrive, then we need to be sort of in this sandbox where they're playing. That means being on Facebook, being on Twitter, being on LinkedIn, having a YouTube channel, using Flickr to post photos from events. The old dated model was, you know, building a fantastic website and assuming that everybody would be migrating to it and coming to your site on a regular basis because they just couldn't live without it. But we realized quickly that, you know, it doesn't work that way, that we need to sort of be in people's faces in a different way.
Right. What were the challenges for you in getting that set up? I would imagine there's probably some concern or resistance initially, or no?
We were very fortunate in that we had, you know, we worked at a university and had a vice principal in our case who was quite understanding of the need to be active in social media. In our case, our vice principal has two teenage boys who were spending a lot of time there. He didn't quite understand the ins and outs of social media to the point where he would micromanage what we were doing, but he understood the importance of it. So he said, I don't really get this stuff, but I know it's really important because my kids and all of their friends who are soon going to be in university are on these tools, on these platforms all the time. So he was certainly very supportive of us sort of redirecting resources to that. The challenge really was one of resources because we, I mean, you know, if you go back to 2008, 2009, right in the throes of the recession, we were a development and alumni relations shop. So, you know, we were certainly not in a expansion mode in terms of adding staff. We were very lucky to sort of just keep our staffing level the same. So it was a question of trying to do something entirely new with existing resources. In our particular case, there was one staff person on our team who was working in a pretty much, what I'd say, a print job, who had a aptitude and affinity and a knowledge of social media. And we basically changed his job around and made it one where he was able to focus more of his energy on social media. Today, we were a communications department of 15 people. That's for development and alumni relations across all channels, including design. And we now have a four-person e-communications or digital communications teams. And two of those four have as one of their major mandates social media.
Right.
We still have an alumni magazine that comes out in print now twice a year. We still do a lot by email.
Okay. Was your alumni magazine only twice a year before this?
It had originally been four times a year. When I arrived, it was three times a year, and we've since then cut it down to twice a year, primarily as a way to cut back a little bit on our printing and postage. The decision to go from three issues to two was coupled with a decision to greatly expand the electronic footprint for the magazine. So before that time, we had a website for the magazine that was basically updated every time the print issue came out with a kind of, you know, PDF of the magazine. For those who really wanted to see it online, we completely overhauled the alumni magazine, the McGill News alumni magazine website, and set it up sort of in a WordPress format where we can put content up whenever we had content to put up. So no longer along the dictates of the printing cycle of the magazine. There's lots of McGill News content that never sees paper anymore. So it basically goes directly from somebody's mind right onto the screen. So we have, you know, regular emails that go out to our alumni, a monthly email can include links to content that is sort of created by the McGill News editorial team.
Then how do you determine what should go in the alumni magazine as opposed to what goes online?
We have sort of a general template that, you know, includes three or four feature stories per issue. So basically a judgment call. I mean, what stories that happen around the a cycle for the print magazine that makes sense, we'll get in the print magazine, and obviously the longer articles as well. And then we use the website as a way to get quick, you know, information out quicker to alumni. And sometimes it appears only online. Sometimes it will appear online and then get into the magazine. One example I can just think of is Felix Baumgartner, the guy who jumped out of space.
So
it turns out, you know, it came to our attention that the gentleman who designed his suit was a McGill graduate who actually stayed in Alberta, right? I think he's in Calgary. So when we found out about this, we were still 3 months away from our next print magazine coming out. But it's a great story. It was timely. So what we did was, that was the kind of story where we, you know, had somebody write it, to put it together, get in touch with this graduate of ours, write an article, and that went online. You know, as opposed to having to wait, you know, 3 or 4 months until it gets to the people's mailbox. We try not to put sort of feature-length articles on the web because, you know, people are generally not going to read 3,000 words in an electronic format. Although, you know, when we started, you know, it was a lot of sort of trial and error at first. You know, something we had to kind of figure out as we went along.
I saw that you've got a whole bunch of different Facebook groups based on different geography, different interests. Can you tell me a bit about how that came about and how the heck you manage all that?
We manage the major sort of central alumni association Facebook page. And then, so there are two other kinds of Facebook pages, generally speaking, that you'll see. So there are others that are represent different parts of the university. So we have 11 faculties at McGill, many of which have started their own Facebook pages and LinkedIn pages, and in some cases Twitter feeds. And those are sort of run by professionals at the university. And then we also have a lot of branch pages that get set up. So some of the, we have about 60 organized volunteer branches. Across North America, or actually around the world. So in many cases, the volunteers in those areas will set up Facebook pages as a, as another way to connect with alumni in their regions. And then you'll have sort of specific niche ones. So, you know, McGill Athletics and others. And of course, the university itself has its own social media properties. And our general rule in that is we encourage people to do that. You know, we keep an eye on things, but we certainly can't manage it the same way we'd be able to manage one of our own direct properties. The strategy behind that, or the thought behind that, is that from a user's point of view, people will want to connect with the university in many different ways. So for some people, being part of the alumni association and that large alumni group of, you know, in this case, about 6,500 fans, on Facebook is something that they want, that appeals to them. In other cases, a law graduate, for instance, that might be too broad for them, and they might feel more comfortable connecting with a Faculty of Law page, or, you know, the Alumni Association of Ottawa page, for instance, or any combination of that. Or they might feel they want to be connected to the larger, you know, McGill Facebook page, although a lot of it depends on what kinds of content they want. So the university social media pages will put out all sorts of information that's mostly geared to a very wide audience. So everyone from media to government officials to prospective students, current and prospective students. Whereas the Alumni Association page, we tend to focus content that is mostly, you know, of interest to alumni and donors.
Mm-hmm.
We realize that people will have all sorts of different interests and wants and needs, and we encourage all of our various units, either the volunteers or the professional faculty ones, to be active. But we try to guide them and train them on sort of best practices if they are going to engage in social media.
And what about the ones that are being run not by professionals, the ones that are being run by volunteer alumni? How do you do any kind of training or work with them? How do you manage that?
We do a little bit of training, particularly with those who ask for it or who want it. So we do keep an eye on what they're doing. We haven't had any cases of abuse. I mean, you know, the biggest challenge that most of these pages will run across, particularly the volunteer ones, is not putting up content on a regular enough basis.
Right.
Because obviously if somebody's going to follow the page, it's got to be, for it to be successful, you have to have content going up in a consistent basis. And obviously as your niche gets more specific and smaller, it becomes more difficult to generate enough exciting content.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way you can really monitor the pages same level as you would in a sort of traditional communications setup. It's social media, it's the web, it's anybody can go on and do what they want. So like I said, we keep an eye on it and we're there to offer guidance as needed. For the volunteers, the branch pages, I mean, the biggest benefit for them is really, it's a way for them to promote events happening in their region.
Sure.
I mean, we have, you know, a lot of emails that go out. The fact we don't have email addresses for everybody, a lot of people tune out their email or are giving us a secondary or tertiary email address. They may not be checking that often.
So were you noticing then that email was becoming a less effective way to connect with alumni?
It's interesting. I actually think that the death of email has been greatly exaggerated. To use an old Mark Twain expression. I think email can still be a very effective marketing tool if used properly. And by that, I mean, I think the biggest mistake people make with email is that they overuse it. And once you as an organization are starting to send out too much email, people automatically start to tune out as soon as they see the name of the sender.
Right.
So we're trying to be much more prudent in our use of email. We try to ensure that our graduates don't get more than one email a week from McGill. It's sometimes difficult because people will fall into various groups. So depending where you live and what faculty you're from, we try our best to make sure they don't get too much email. We're trying as best as we can to be more specific with their email. What I mean by that is sending people information on the kinds of things that would interest them. So if we know, for instance, that specific alumni of ours are interested in the environment or issues of sustainability, then we'll try to send them more information around those areas. So, I mean, that's still a bit of a pipe dream because it's a model that retailers use very often and very effectively. We're not quite at that level of sophistication yet.
So you're looking at doing finer segmentation.
Yeah, the ultimate objective, specifically when we do any fundraising by email. So when we, when we're working on behalf of the annual fund, trying to reach people with causes that we think they might be interested in within the large McGill suite of interests.
Right.
That takes a lot of energy and a lot of resources, and we're sort of just scratching the surface on that.
What impact did the protests have on how you were doing things online?
By and large, our alumni were quite sympathetic to the university. Many of the protesting students were against that, and our alumni, by and large, supported the university and felt that tuitions should increase in Quebec. Many of them had been students many, many, many years ago and were paying the same levels of tuition that today's current students are paying. We tried not to get too much into the debate in social media or even with our email and general communications. You know, we did some content on it. So, for instance, we had one of our monthly emails that goes out to our alumni. One of our planned editions happened to be going out a week before the Quebec election, where the whole issue of tuition was very core to the decision that Quebecers had to make. And we actually, after some debate, we decided to actually write an article. It was actually our lead article in that email that looked at sort of the issues in a very broad sense. And we had some experts from McGill who were in interviewed in that story. And we actually received quite a bit of interest. It was one of our most read articles. One of the things that we did learn, we actually did a survey a couple of years ago of all of our alumni. One of the questions we asked our alumni is, what do you suggest McGill and the Alumni Association do when there's bad news? And overwhelmingly, I think it was something like 77, but it was close to 80% of our alumni responded that when there is bad news happening on campus, they prefer to hear it from us directly rather than secondhand through the media.
Right.
So we sort of took that to heart, and there were some instances where we did send out emails during the year when things got particularly hot on campus,
mm-hmm.
and we felt that it was important to go to our alumni, you know, with a message, either from the principal or from someone else in the administration. We had one particular case, which you may or may not have heard of, back in the spring where somebody broke into our donor database and posted a bunch of confidential information on a website called McGill Leaks. And we got wind of that on, like, I think it was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday, and quickly huddled and, you know, we're sort of debating what to do about this. And we made the decision, rightfully, I think, to get an email out to all of our donors that evening, because we knew that, you know, journalists were coming around, they were covering the story, and we knew they would be in the morning papers the next day. So we made sure that before we went home that night, an email went out. I think we had about 50,000 donors with an email address, with every single one of them
mm-hmm.
received an email from us explaining what happened. We didn't, you know, it was still a very fluid story. We didn't know, you know, all the details yet, but we felt it was important to get something out to our alumni and don't, in this case our donors, that they would see it from us. We received tremendous feedback from our donors for doing that. And I think we managed to contain a situation that could have gone out of hand.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real tenets of social media, or at least of functioning in this era, is you've got to be open and fast.
Okay.
And it sounds like you did that. Now, what happened in your Twitter and Facebook pages, though, during the whole protest thing, or during that case with the
well, it's funny, during the specific McGill Leak incident, there was quite a bit of chatter on Twitter,
right.
in particular, which was quite interesting, and it was mostly very flattering, actually. I mean, Twitter's a funny place, generally speaking, and it was actually quite, I won't say amusing, but it was quite interesting, you know, and somewhat amusing to follow some of the chatter about McGill and about this sort of leaking of information. One of the general trends that seemed to come out of it was people's amazement at what wonderful data we kept on our donors. People had no idea that we were so good at collecting information and data on our donors. So here we were being very, you know, feeling somewhat defensive about the fact that, you know, yes, we do collect data on our donors, and this has now come out, and oh my gosh, what are people going to think? And,
yeah.
You know, people were quite impressed by our level of data collection.
That's interesting, because I would have thought people would be upset. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, we had there were a few people that were upset, but the majority the majority of comments we got on social media was quite encouraging. I will say that in general, we don't find too many people resorting to social media to complain about stuff. And we do get every once in a while. We get a lot of questions that come in through social media, particularly Facebook. People will come to our Facebook page looking for information, or sometimes, you know, they get exasperated trying to find information on the web or by calling people, and they'll come to our Facebook page and ask us to connect them with somebody who can help them. We don't get a lot of people, particularly on the Alumni Association page at least, being very critical of the institution or coming to us with particular grievances they have. Most of those tend to come in by email. We will, you know, when we do send emails out, particularly when we send emails of a solicitation nature, if there are some controversial things going on in the world of McGill, we very often will get responses. You know, people will respond to the email, something like, you know, how dare you ask me for money at this time when I'm so upset about the asbestos research, or, you know, you know, the fact that my daughter was on campus when the protest took place.
Right.
So we tend to get a lot of that feedback by email, surprisingly, not so much on social media.
Interesting.
And I think, a little bit of that, it's interesting because I know people, and I've done it myself, rarely, but I have done it, when people have a grievance with a company, a retail company, everybody runs to social media, and I had a friend who had their luggage lost by Air Canada, was having a really hard time getting it back, and he was using Twitter as a way to get Air Canada's attention. And it's interesting, we don't see the same thing as much as we do at McGill with the Alumni Association pages, and perhaps it's because you don't have that anonymity. So, you know, people are connected to the Alumni Association. Their former classmates are on there, so maybe they're more reluctant to go public with their grievances against McGill in a public forum like that.
Hmm.
We've actually enabled a lot of our websites to accept comments, and we obviously monitor all of them. And we will sometimes get people that will post negative comments, and unless mm-hmm. it's something egregious or slanderous or, you know, factually incorrect, we'll let those comments stand.
Yep.
And we find whenever that happens, inevitably there seems to be a bunch more people who will come on and defend the university's reputation.
Mm-hmm.
These are our fans, you know. They are people that have an affinity to McGill.
Which is great.
You know, they obviously had a good experience. They want to stay connected mm-hmm. with us. So what we do hear a lot about are graduates of ours whose children are unable to get, who have not been accepted. But those complaints always come in by phone or by email. I can't see somebody going to a public forum like Facebook to
right.
castigate the university for not accepting their son or daughter. I just
right.
think it's...
Well, tell them to study harder, damn it. Can you tell me about some of the things or campaigns that you've run that have been particularly successful?
Probably our most notable campaign, I guess it's about a year and a half ago now, we launched what we called the Greatest McGillians Contest. So this was as the university was getting set to celebrate its 190th anniversary. It was sort of modeled a little bit on, the CBC had done something mm-hmm. a few years earlier, you know, identifying the 50 greatest Canadians of all time. So we said, you know, let's find out who are the 10 greatest McGillians of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a traditional contest in the sense that, you know, there was a website where we were taking comments and having conversation around that. We had advertising in our print alumni magazine, and we had lots of email. But what made the contest so successful and so unique was the fact that we use social media as a major component of the promotion of the campaign. So we had, for example, contests. We ended up narrowing it down to the top 20. There were sort of various phases. So first we went to our
okay.
alumni through all these various channels, including social media, and asked people to nominate someone who they thought was the greatest McGillian. And it could be someone who was an alum or a faculty member
okay.
or, you know, anyone associated with, you know, a former principal, current principal. And we had about 700 nominations. From there, we
mm-hmm.
sort of narrowed the list down to top 20. We actually
sure.
had a ballot that was printed in the alumni magazine, sent by email, was posted on the website. And we said, you know, the contest is open, please vote. And then what we did was found 20 people who would go on camera and defend a particular candidate. But for each of the candidates, so, you know, somebody who thought Ken Dryden was a great McGillian or somebody who thought William Shatner. So we created these 20 videos and put them all on our YouTube channel. And we pushed them out. Most of this contest actually took place during the summer,
mm-hmm.
the voting. So it was not a time when people were necessarily around all the time. But we had quite a lot of success in, particularly in Facebook and Twitter.
Right.
We also ran a contest on Facebook and Twitter where every day, I think it was over a 10-week period, so twice a week, we'd start the morning with a kind of contest, like, who am I? And it'd be one of the 20 McGillians, one of the 20 finalists, and people can come on and take a guess at who this person was.
Yeah.
We'd unveil some arcane fact about this finalist. People would go on and try to guess who it was. So again, it was an interesting way to maintain interest.
Oh, that's cool.
Particularly in, you know, July and August. And then we had over 60,000 votes.
60,000.
It ended up being quite a heated contest. It was actually interesting. I mean, a lot of the feedback we got, I mean, most of it was great. People were voting and having debates about who the greatest McGillian was. But, you know, we had a lot of people who were, like, offended by the contest. How dare you decide by popular vote who the greatest McGillian is? And, you know, we had to write back to people and ask them to kind of, you know, chill it. It's just a fun contest. But there's no way we would have had that much interest if we
mm-hmm.
were relying strictly on, you know, the one print magazine that came out during the campaign, you know, and the few emails we were going to be sending out.
So did that, I mean, say you got some 60,000 vote. Well, I guess you wouldn't know who was voting, because I was just going to ask if that increased your reach in terms of connecting with alumni with whom you might not have been connected.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always hard to measure the long-term impact of
right.
something like this.
Mm-hmm.
So we imagine that there many of the people are people we were already connected with, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
we presume that it spread a little bit virally as well.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, something like this was really meant just as a way to generate interest, generate buzz about McGill, and it's really
mm-hmm.
the basis of most of the communications we do. Again, everything from the print magazine to emails we send out that are just talking about interesting things. One of the most popular things that we do on Facebook, whenever we post photos of campus, so, you know, the first snowfall of the year, we'll put a picture
mm-hmm.
up and you'll have, like, you know, 100 likes within an hour kind of thing. And you know, people along to are in Florida were like, oh, it's, you know, 30 degrees here. We really miss the snow. That kind of thing. Or we'll do things like on a weekly basis, we'll do something nostalgic. So it was funny. I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, we posted a picture of Kraft Dinner. And said, you know, Kraft Dinner is still a popular, you know, item among, you know, starving students at McGill. What were some of the things, you know, you ate when you were a student? And it was interesting. People really, really get into that. I think the nostalgia piece is quite, and the one thing I will say about social media that surprised me a little bit is the demographics we're seeing. It's much older. The people that are on, following us and commenting tend to be much older than what you would expect. So it's not all 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds. We have lots of graduates of the 70s and 80s.
Do you find that there's a difference in terms of different types of social media by age? Are people of a certain age group more likely, say, to be on Twitter versus Facebook? Or
Twitter, it's harder for us to tell.
Yeah.
Because we don't have the same sort of... I mean, I know that the demographics say that Twitter tends to be a little bit older than Facebook. I think Twitter, it's like, what, early 40s, I believe, is the median age.
Although that's been changing, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's getting a bit younger now, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Facebook, I think, is going the opposite direction. It started out young, and it's getting a bit older.
Yeah.
It's harder to tell on Twitter in terms of who's following us. I mean, Facebook, when people comment, I mean, I suppose we can do a drill down, and that's one thing which we're actually looking at doing, we just haven't got around to it yet, is actually doing a drill down, seeing who are these people, how many of the alumni fans are actually alumni. I presume most of them are. Where do they live? You know, when did they graduate? What field of study? Are they donors? Are they not donors? Is there a connection between being a donor and following us on social media? So a lot of analytical work we still need to do. My comment was more anecdotal because when you see the kinds of comments people will put on Facebook and they're talking about, you know, their experience at McGill, at least the comments that are of a nostalgic nature tend to be posted by older alums whom you wouldn't even think would be on Facebook. Yeah. I think we're just scratching the surface of what we're able to do. I think we've proven that social media can be a very valuable tool in terms of, you know, alumni engagement and getting people talking about the McGill brand and revisiting it as alumni would. The challenge now is to try to be more strategic and figure out what does all of this mean in the greater picture of all the communications we're doing and all the alumni engagement we're doing? We know it's critical to the university in some fashion. We haven't quite figured out what are the actual returns. Great. You know, the media relations office managed to get a front page story in the Globe and Mail. Wonderful. What does that mean? And I think we're dealing with a lot of those same issues around social media. And I speak to a lot of my colleagues who are dealing with the same thing, where I think there was a lot of leeway early on in the game, like my VP and others who said, we know this is important, go knock yourselves out, devote resources to it. And now here we are 5 years into it, and they're coming back to us and saying, okay, well, what do we have to show for this? Well, we have 16,000 members on LinkedIn, and we have, you know, 6,500 fans on Facebook, and we have Twitter, and then we have YouTube views, and they say, okay, that's wonderful, but what do we have to show for it? And, you know, that's where I think we need, I think we as a communications profession, as advancing professionals, need to figure out more specifically what is the return on investment on all of this. And can we develop a set of metrics whereby we can say having more Facebook fans does in fact, you know, bring more support to the development side of the house? And I think it's also getting people to understand the numbers we're dealing with. So a funny analogy that one of my other colleagues in the States shared with me, he said, you know, when Facebook was starting to grow, you know, they would often compare themselves to the sizes of various countries. So they would say, you know, if Facebook were our country, it would be the seventh largest in the world or the fourth largest, or I think now it would be the third largest. The language I try to talk to when I speak to my non-communications colleagues in advancement at McGill, you know, is to look at our various social media communities as communities. So we have 16,000 plus members on LinkedIn, and we have somebody who part of their day manages that community. And people sort of shrug their shoulders and say, so what? Well, I say, if I look at the McGill alumni community, you know, we have, you know, 100,000 graduates in Montreal, and we have 25,000 McGill graduates in Toronto. if LinkedIn were a community, it would be our third largest alumni community. And all of a sudden, people take notice because we certainly have lots of resources going into engage our alumni in Toronto, because you were not going to let 25,000 alumni just drift away. So why would you let 16,000 alumni drift away? And not only is it 16,000, these are 16,000 alumni who have actually stepped up and raised their hand and say, I want in. And Facebook, close to 7,000 fans, it's a number that's, you know, it's not, you know, when compared to 200,000 active alumni, it's not that big. But, you know, we don't have that many physical alumni communities that have 7,000 people. You know, it would be the ones I mentioned, Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa. So Facebook would be our fourth largest alumni community for McGill.
Right.
So why would you not devote resources to keeping those people engaged?
That's a really interesting way to position it. One final question. What would your advice or suggestions be to a university if they were thinking of getting more active in social media at this point?
I would say absolutely do it. For the reasons we talked about earlier, that's where people are spending more time. I think the average person spends, I think it's 12 minutes a day on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we spend 12 minutes a day doing much else, you know, other than maybe sleeping. You know, I mean, we don't spend, you know, 12 minutes a day on any other website. I mean, you know, people spend so much time on Facebook, so much time on Twitter, so much time on LinkedIn, especially now with mobile technology. You don't even need to be at a computer to be on Facebook. You can be in line at the bank or at Tim Hortons. You're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, especially, certainly if you're like me. So I think just by the fact that that's where people are hanging out and spending a lot of time, I think you as an organization, as a brand, need to be there. My second advice would be to make sure you do it properly. And if you're going to go in, go all in. So what we've learned, you know, early on in the process is that when it comes to any of these social media tools or platforms, you know, content really is king. I know it's a cliche, but, you know, content is king, but it really is. I think you need to be there and be felt, be a presence there. So we're pretty disciplined in terms of our use of Facebook and Twitter in particular. We make sure to put up content, you know, 3 or 4 times a day. Not abusing it too much, but you want to be there on a regular basis, because as you know, the way these platforms work is, you know, it's all the news feeds. And, you know, I may check my account once a day or twice a day or 6 times a day, or maybe only once every few days.
Right.
But if you're in the regular news cycle and you're putting out interesting content on a regular basis, there's a better chance that you're going to catch people. You know, I follow some brands that don't put any content up for 3 weeks, and all of a sudden there's like 7 items that go up right away. So if I happen to be on Facebook at that moment, I'll see the content. In fact, like these 7 items, I might get a bit annoyed. But odds are I'm going to miss that. So the idea is, I think, really to spread it out as evenly as you can, and make it somebody's responsibility. And I mean, I volunteer for, you know, a nonprofit organization, and, you know, they're struggling with social media, you know, because again, it's, they're not, the communications people aren't the ones jumping on and taking it seriously. So in this case, we're dealing with people who work in sort of volunteer management and planning, and, you know, they're trying to be something on social media, but they're not. They just don't have the time or the skills to do it.
Yeah.
So, and the final thing I'd say is just be interesting on social media. You know, provide interesting content. You know, it's not just another vehicle to ask people for money. And I think if you try to do that, you know, people do that. And if you try to do that, people will see right through it. You know, generally we tend to follow like the 80-20 rule, whereas 80% of the posts will be just general content that we think people will be interested in. You know, and, you know, maximum 20% of the posts will be something where we're actually asking people to do something. Come to our event, you know, support the annual fund. And 20% is even generous. I don't even think it's that high. But we're lucky at a university because there's so much interesting content, and it's not hard to find stuff.
Right.
If you're working for a nonprofit that maybe doesn't have such a wide scope of activity other than, you know, trying to raise money, it might become more difficult. But even then, I would not go above 20% of the content being asking people to do something.
A few of the points that Derek made, I think, really can be generalized to all organizations. One of them is his comment that the biggest mistake people make that he's seen with email is that they overuse it. And in particular, in large, complex organizations like universities, it's very easy to bombard an alumni with a whole bunch of email from different parts of the university. So you've got the alumni people, you've got the fundraising people from the university as a whole and from their individual faculty, possibly even at the departmental level. So it's really important for organizations to streamline, coordinate, and think through how much is any one individual going to be getting mail. He also really made the point about the importance of list segmentation. Think about who is most likely to be interested in what type of content instead of just blasting everything to everybody. Another point that I think really applies much more broadly than just to university fundraisers is that when bad news happens with your company, try to make sure that your audience hears it from you first. Even if it's simply a tweet and a note on your Facebook page and on your website saying, okay, this situation has happened, we're looking into it, and we'll keep you posted. Always, always better if they hear it from you rather than from other sources. I was also intrigued by his notion in terms of the grand ROI debate, return on investment, to prove the value of what you're doing can be particularly challenging when you're not selling anything directly, or when, as in with alumni relations, there can be a very long-term impact on fundraising, and it's not always easy to see what led to the final donation decisions. I was intrigued by his idea of looking at their LinkedIn community or their Facebook page community in the same way as though it were a physical community. In the same way that, for instance, increasingly some companies are starting to treat their online store as though it were a physical store and give it the same kind of attention and value. His final point that is particularly important and applies everywhere is make social media somebody's responsibility. It is totally unrealistic to assume that everyone's going to chip in a little bit and they'll just sort of add it on to what their existing responsibilities are. Think through who's going to run social media for your organization, what are their responsibilities, and what is their capacity to get feedback and input from other people within the organization? What kind of power do they have to ask for it or encourage it? How can that system work? That's all for today. I look forward to chatting with you next week. In the meantime, I do hope you'll send along your feedback on the show. There are many ways to do that. You can send me an email, Tema, T-E-M-A, at frankonlinemarketing.com, or visit the website, frankonlinemarketing.com. And there you'll find there's a little button you can click so you can leave a voicemail. Or of course, you can always go to our Facebook page or my Twitter account, which is at Tema Frank, whatever works best for you. I do look forward to getting your feedback on the show and to chatting with you next week. Bye for now.